Most corporate responsibility is defensive, explained Douglas. Let's not get caught using underage workers in Burma. You never really thought you could make a lot more money by being more corporately responsible. Not anymore. Now the whole energy frontier may become a source of competitive advantage, he explained. We are making our costs lower and selling more energy-efficient products and then deploying them internally and making ourselves more efficient. This means we get to play offense on corporate social responsibility, and playing offense is always a lot more fun. Only a company or a country whose chief executive officer is also a chief energy officer, someone who is thinking holistically about all the costs and benefits, will be able to outgreen the competition. Why? Because most companies in the world operated the way the U.S. military did. They never looked at the total cost of ownership in making their energy decisions. Often, the people who designed or purchased products inside a company and the people who used those products and the people who paid the electricity or fuel bills for those products were all different people. So the vice president for equipment buys the lowest cost machine to make his budget look good. But the vice president for accounting, who pays the electric bills, is on his back every day because that same low-cost machine was the one that sucked up the most energy when electricity prices started to soar. And when electricity prices went through the roof, that cheap machine actually cost the company over its life cycle far more than the expensive, super energy-efficient model would have. Because no one had a bird's-eye view of all the costs and benefits of energy decisions, money and resources were continually wasted. If you see green only from your silo, you only see increased costs, explained Jeff Wacker, the futurist at EDS. You don't see the trade-offs. You don't see the decrease somewhere else, because it's not in your silo where that something else happens. So you need the CEO who can say, let's go for an initially more expensive but low-heat, low-energy lighting system, because that will allow us to design and install and operate fewer air conditioners. Only if you look at it systemically can you measure all the savings, said Wacker. Once you start to measure, you recognize the benefits for the whole system. Which is why, I suspect, in the energy climate era, if you don't run your company or country like a chief energy officer, you're not going to be very effective as a chief executive officer. You are never going to optimize all the assets under your control. If your thinking is limited to your silo, you will buy one and get less than one back. If your thinking stretches across your whole system, you will buy one and get four or five more for free. And that's how you get an edge on the competition. About going green, remarked Douglas. I don't remember who said it, but they sure were right. It's like there was all this money lying all over the floor, and we finally decided to have our employees reach down and pick it up. Code Green for me, though, has never been just a business or a geopolitical strategy, as important as those are. This program makes a larger claim, that the best way to re-energize America, rebuild its self-confidence and moral authority, and propel it forward as a society, is also by focusing on a green agenda. Therefore, outgreening has to be a strategy not only for beating the company, army, or city next door, but also for beating poverty at our back door. Code Green has to prove that it can offer something to the very lowest rungs of the economic ladder, not just to upper middle class people. If all Americans can't see outgreening as a strategy that could improve their lives, it will never generate the momentum and scale that it needs to succeed. That may sound like a stretch, but it's not. Ask Van Jones. He's good at stretching. I met him at a conference in Dalian, China, when he stretched out an arm to introduce himself, as he was going down an escalator and I was going up the other side. Jones is a rare bird. He's a black social activist in Oakland, and he's as green an environmentalist as they come. He really gets passionate and funny when he talks about what it's like to be black and green. "Try this experiment," he says to me. "Go knock on someone's door in West Oakland, Watts, or Newark, and say, 'We got a really big problem.' They say, 'We do? We do? Yeah, we got a really big problem. We do? We do? Yeah, we gotta save the polar bears. You may not make it out of this neighborhood alive, but we gotta save the polar bears.'" Jones then just shakes his head. If you try that approach on people without jobs, who live in neighborhoods where they've got a lot better chance of getting killed by a passing shooter than a melting glacier, you're going to get nowhere. And if you don't bring America's underclass into the green movement, this movement's full potential will never be realized. "We need a different on-ramp for people from disadvantaged communities," says Jones. "The leaders of the climate establishment came in through one door, and now they want to squeeze everyone through that same door. It's not going to work. If we want to have a broad-based environmental movement, we need more entry points." The big question, Jones told me in an interview, is this: how do you use the green economy to deliver work, wealth, and health for communities who have had too little of all three? How do you connect the people who most need work with the work that most needs to be done? And if you do it right, beat pollution and poverty at the same time. Can we really outgreen poverty and pollution at the same time? Jones makes a strong and impassioned case that we can, and he has been trying to prove it in some of the poorest neighborhoods in America. 39 years old and a Yale Law School grad, he exudes enough energy to light up a few buildings on his own. He founded the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland, which helps kids get out of jail and into jobs, but he moved in 2008 to run Green for All, a new national organization working to build an inclusive green economy with a specific focus on creating green-collar jobs for underprivileged young people. Again, it all starts with a world that is getting hot, flat, and crowded. The more these trends intensify, the more state and local governments will require buildings to be energy efficient, and the more work there will be retrofitting buildings all across America with solar panels, insulation, and other weatherizing materials. Those are jobs that can't be outsourced. You can't take a building you want to weatherize, put it on a ship to China, and then have them do it and send it back, said Jones. So we are going to have to put people to work in this country, weatherizing millions of buildings, putting up solar panels, constructing wind farms. Those green-collar jobs can provide a pathway out of poverty for someone who has not gone to college. Let's tell our disaffected youth, he says, you can make more money if you put down that handgun and pick up a caulk gun. Remember, adds Jones, a big chunk of the African-American community is economically stranded. The blue-collar, stepping-stone manufacturing jobs are becoming fewer and fewer, and they're not being replaced by anything except higher-skilled jobs. So you have this whole generation of young blacks who are basically in economic freefall. Green-collar retrofitting jobs are a way to catch some of them. To this end, Jones helped create the Oakland Apollo Alliance, a coalition of labor unions, environmental organizations, and community groups. In 2007, that coalition helped to raise $250,000 from the city government to create Oakland Green Jobs Corps, a union-supported training program to teach young people in Oakland how to put up solar panels and weatherize buildings. That was the beginning of the Green for All campaign, greenforall.org, that Jones, backed by other environmental activists like Majora Carter from Sustainable South Bronx, used to persuade Congress to pass the Green Jobs Act of 2007, which authorized $125 million per year from the federal government to create an Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy Worker Training Program to prepare workers for jobs in a range of green industries. Congress has not yet appropriated the money. The big problem with the job training is that too often it is all about throwing certificates at people, whether they get a job or not, said Jones. But more often than not, they come to some school or an institute, get a certificate, and there is no job on the other side. The beauty of a green jobs program is that there is no question whatsoever, as building codes change and green technologies make retrofitting your home a no-brainer, that green-collar jobs will be there waiting for anyone who gets trained to do them. And the beauty of this initiative, if it can be made to work, is that like other forms of out-greening, you buy one and you get four others for free. The more we make tax incentives available for retrofitting homes to make them more energy efficient and to encourage use of solar technologies, the more we strengthen the ability of poor people to stay in their homes and secure their neighborhoods. I'll let Jones explain. There is a category of very vulnerable poor people who own their own homes but tend to be older and on fixed incomes, he says. They are very vulnerable to soaring energy prices. If the government, he added, put in place a program that said, "We're going to send teams in to find out where your home is leaking energy and then install the installation, weatherization, and a few solar panels," we could create jobs for underprivileged youth, lower energy bills for lower-income families, and add value into the homes of the most economically vulnerable sector of the population. For a lot of underprivileged people, greening their homes may be the only way to keep them in their homes as fuel prices continue to soar. Those homeowners are the most stable pillars of any neighborhood. Make their homes energy secure and their kids' jobs secure, and you stabilize the neighborhood, said Jones. And you get cleaner air to boot. You fix social problems and ecology problems at the same time. You help grandma and the polar bears stay at home. This is an industry that is ready to take off. If we can get these youth in on the ground floor of the solar industry now, where they can be installers today, they'll become managers in 5 years and owners in 10, and then become investors, argues Jones. The entry-level rung is low enough, but the ladder reaches to the sun. If you green the ghetto first, he added, and spend $7,000 training Pookie and giving him a life skill, it is a lot better than warehousing Pookie in a prison for $500,000. Save a what? Save a life. It's all the same principle. In a green economy, you don't just count what you spend, you count what you save. One thing spurring him in this project, added Jones, was the way that the big oil companies bought ads in black-owned newspapers in California in 2006 to help bring out black votes by dishonestly scaring people about higher gasoline prices to defeat Proposition 87. Proposition 87 proposed a tax on oil companies drilling in California, the money from which would have gone to develop alternative energy programs. The polluters were able to stampede poor people into their camp, said Jones. I never want to see an NAACP leader on the wrong side of an environment issue again. Not surprisingly, some of the worst polluting factories, power plants, and toxic waste dumps are located in poor neighborhoods, where people have little power to defend themselves against such projects. What I find most compelling about Jones's argument is something that goes to the core thesis of this book. It used to be that the greener you were, the further away you were from ordinary Americans. Green was all about yoga mats, Birkenstock sandals, tofu, and individual lifestyle choices that often separated greens from average Americans. When you start to redefine green in the way Jones does, you come closer to ordinary Americans' concerns. In a real green economy, said Jones, you don't have any throwaway resources. You don't have throwaway species, and you don't have throwaway neighborhoods, and you don't have throwaway kids either. I have not met a white person who would not support this kind of approach if they thought it could work. A green agenda brings us all together again, because the hope at the core nourishes everybody. The last time someone said, I have a dream in America, it was a dream about people, said Jones. This is a dream about people and the planet. We need to put the two together, because the moral power of that will give us our dream. For all these reasons, even though outgreening is not a word yet, I hope it will be soon, in every language. Because this is not a zero-sum competition. I can outgreen your company, country, or community in one area, and you can outgreen me in another. I can outgreen you today, and you can outgreen me tomorrow, and we will all be better off. But whoever outgreens and keeps outgreening will be the best off for the longest time, because the best employees are going to say, that is the company I want to work for. The best students are going to say, that is the school I want to attend. The most global citizens are going to say, that is the country I want to follow. India and China may take away a few American jobs with cheaper labor, but those are transient advantages. However, if one of these countries consistently outgreens America, they will be seizing a sustainable advantage. In the energy climate era, you cannot be the leader of the world without being the world's leader in conceptualizing, designing, manufacturing, deploying, and inspiring clean power solutions. Period. Full stop. Over and out. Part 4. China. Chapter 15. Can Red China Become Green China? I've visited China regularly since 1990, and here's what strikes me most. Each time I go there, China's people seem to speak with greater ease and breathe with greater difficulty. Yes, you can now have strikingly frank talks with officials and journalists in China. But when I walked out of my hotel room heading for an interview the last time I visited Shanghai, in November 2006, the air was so smoky from the burning of farm fields after the harvest that for a moment I honestly thought my hotel was on fire. For some 3 decades now, China's economy has grown at around 10% per year, based on low-cost labor and little regard for the waste and pollution it pumped into its rivers and the air. For many years, when you asked about pollution, officials and business leaders in China would say they will clean up when China gets rich enough to afford to clean up. I would argue that now that we are entering the energy climate era, China can get rich only if it cleans up. Unless Red China becomes Green China, the Communist Party leadership will not be able to deliver to all the Chinese people the rising standard of living it has promised. China cannot afford to do what the West did. Grow now, clean up later. I know that this strikes many Chinese as unfair, which is why global warming is perceived by more than a few Chinese as a conspiracy concocted by the West to slow China's growth. It is unfair if you consider how much CO2 the Western industrialized countries blithely pumped into the atmosphere long before the Chinese industrial dragon ever started huffing and puffing, and how the West has shipped its dirtiest manufacturing industries to China. But Mother Nature isn't into fair. All she knows is hard science and raw math. If China were to try to grow now and clean up later, the unprecedented pace and scale of its development would lead to an environmental disaster. It's all in the numbers. China is one-fifth of humanity. It's now the world's biggest carbon emitter. It is the world's second-largest importer of oil after the United States, and, according to a report in the Times of London, January 28, 2008, it is already the world's largest importer of nickel, copper, aluminum, steel, coal, and iron ore. Timber is certainly up there as well. It is not an exaggeration to say, as goes China, so goes planet Earth. If China can make a stable transition to clean power and an energy and resource-efficient economy, we, as a planet, have a chance to mitigate climate change, energy poverty, petro-dictatorship, and biodiversity loss in significant ways. If China can't, China's emissions and appetites will nullify everything everyone else does to save the Earth, and the energy-climate era will careen toward the unmanageable. So, for me, the crucial question of this program is actually two questions. Can America really lead a real green revolution? And can China really follow? Everything else is just commentary. To put it in the local vernacular, Deng Xiaoping once famously said of China's economy, "Black cat, white cat, all that matters is that it catches mice." That is, forget about communist ideology. All that matters is that China grows. Not anymore. Now, if that cat isn't green, neither it nor the mice nor any of the rest of us are going to make it. So how's China doing? The best short answer I've heard comes from the longtime Asia watcher Nayan Chanda, the former editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review and now editor of Yale Global Online. When I asked Chanda for his views on China's energy and environment performance, he answered with barely a pause, "Go rent the movie Speed." That 1994 thriller stars Keanu Reeves, Dennis Hopper, and Sandra Bullock. Reeves plays Jack Traven, an LAPD SWAT team specialist who is sent to defuse a bomb that Howard Payne, a revenge-driven extortionist, Dennis Hopper, has planted on a bus. But here's the rub. The bomb has been rigged to explode the second the speed of the bus falls below 50 miles per hour. So Jack and Annie Porter, a passenger played by Sandra Bullock, must keep the bus hurtling through the streets of Los Angeles at more than 50 miles per hour, or they, the bomb, and everything around them will go up in flames. "China is that bus," said Chanda. "It has to grow at a minimum of 8% a year, or it will explode," he added, "because it will have so much unemployment and discontent, the population will erupt." The implicit ruling bargain that the Chinese Communist Party has offered the people of China has been very clear ever since the end of Mao's era. It goes like this. "We are replacing communism with GDPism. GDPism says, we get to rule. You, the people, get to become prosperous. You accept our rule. We guarantee your rising prosperity." Without a steadily rising gross domestic product, without that China bus going 50 miles per hour, that ruling bargain would unravel. But my own regular visits to China over the past two decades have taught me that while this remains the ruling bargain, China's leaders, who are very shrewd, have come to understand that in a world that is becoming hot, flat, and crowded, China cannot sustain this ruling bargain any longer without adding a footnote in fine print. And the fine print now says, "This ruling bargain is subject to limitations that China will soon have to impose on itself because the environmental, energy, and biodiversity implications of China's largely coal-powered growth will, if unrestrained, end up killing Chinese, irredeemably polluting China's environment, sapping its economy, and alienating the rest of the world. If the rest of the world, particularly the United States, moves in the next few years to some form of carbon tax, or if Mother Nature imposes even harsher punishments in her own way, China will have to move away from cheap and dirty fuels. Otherwise, it will face a boycott of its goods. Therefore, the Communist Party reserves the right to slow down growth in the name of cleaning up the economy. China's leaders may not have spelled out that footnote to themselves or their people in so many words, but it is the logic driving where they need to go and have already started moving. That is why, when you add it all up, there is no avoiding the conclusion that China's leadership is engaged in one of the most daring political high-wire acts ever attempted on the world stage. As Chanda put it, China's leaders are trying to replace the motor in that Chinese bus from a gas-guzzling polluter to a super-efficient hybrid, but they're trying to do it while the bus is still going 50 miles an hour. This could be the greatest show on Earth. The drama unfolding in China is so compelling because the same Communist Party that 3 decades ago replaced communism with GDPism is now trying to replace GDPism with green GDPism. And what's most fascinating about this show is how the Chinese leadership has decided, after a lot of trial and error, to go about it. The bus driver has turned around, told the passengers that the engine needs to be changed, without specifying exactly how it's to be done, and even started allowing some of the passengers to jump into the engine well and tinker. China's leaders have come to understand that they can't change this engine alone. At first, as mounting pollution became an issue in the 1990s, China's leaders tried to engineer green GDPism the same way they did the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, by just ordering it from the top down. But that didn't work. Plain old GDPism, growth at any price, had too much momentum. So now they are trying a more top-down plus bottom-up approach that involves allowing the Chinese press to spotlight environmental polluters, passing progressive energy efficiency laws, encouraging investments in clean power research and technology, and granting China's civil society some of the legal tools to bring violators to trial. I would not describe it as a system yet. It is often one step forward and 2 steps back. And sometimes the same local leader or businessman acts like a pure GDPist in the morning and as a green GDPist in the afternoon. In real life, especially in societies in transition, people often have multiple identities. But it is happening, and it appears to be China's strategy for switching from dirty capitalism to relatively clean capitalism without having to slow down the bus too much. We tend to think in grand systematic ways, but in fact, if you look back, China's leadership moved from a communist centrally planned system to a capitalist market society without having a grand plan, said Edward S. Steinfeld, a China specialist at MIT and the author of Forging Reform in China, The Fate of State-Owned Industry. It was done in an incremental, non-systematic way, and the same thing seems to be happening with environmentalism. Some in the leadership are recognizing the dire costs of growth. They are not flipping a switch to turn it off, but they are empowering forces in society and the media to do something about it. It produces this kind of whirlpool of competing claims and impulses, but it is moving in a certain direction. This strategy raises several fundamental questions, and they are the focus of this chapter. What exactly got China's leaders to move from GDPism to green GDPism? Are they moving fast enough? What role can the United States play in supporting China's green leap forward? And maybe most important, by granting more power to the Chinese people so they can protect their freedom to breathe, will China's Communist Party leadership unleash political forces that, over time, will give the Chinese people much more freedom to speak? Could this turn out to be the first big democracy movement that starts as an environmental movement? Could a movement that begins with people being empowered to pursue their right to breathe, their right to drink clean water, and their right to see the stars in the sky at night, asks Chanda, end with people securing their right to speak because you cannot do one without the other? Could a battle over the right to inhale, added Chanda, end with more rights to exhale? Most China experts would tell you the answer is no. But when you look at the scope and scale of what China is going to need to do to wrestle its pollution problems to the ground, you see that it could end up requiring and stimulating more political change than anyone now realizes. What got the Chinese leadership to move toward green GDPism? Probably nothing more than looking out the window. It's not like they could miss the problem, even riding in a limousine with tinted glass. An American friend in Beijing tells me that every morning he gets up and does his own air quality test, as many Beijing residents do. He looks out his 24th story window and checks how far he can see. On a rare, pristine day, when the wind has swept Beijing clean, he can see the fragrant mountain rising to the northwest. On a good pollution day, he can see the China World Building 4 blocks away. On a bad day, he can't see the building next door. Those are the days when Beijing is enveloped by a film of pollution from exhaust given off by the 1,000 new cars a day on top of the 3 million existing cars that hit the road there, mixed with emissions from coal-burning power plants and factories, as well as dust from construction sites, from off the deserts, and from cement plants running full out. It's almost too much to have asked, but China should have learned from America's mistake, skipped cars altogether, and gone directly to the world's best mass transit system. Because to fuel all these vehicles for a burgeoning Chinese middle class is going to be an endless economic drain and an environmental nightmare. The problem of conventional pollution reached a degree of criticality in recent years that not only made it inescapable, but made future trend lines terrifying for the Chinese leadership if they took no action. As the Deputy Minister of China's State Environmental Protection Agency, Pan Yu, said in a famously candid interview with Der Spiegel, March 7, 2005, many factors are coming together here. Our raw materials are scarce, we don't have enough land, and our population is constantly growing. Currently, there are 1.3 billion people living in China. That's twice as many as 50 years ago. In 2020, there will be 1.5 billion people in China. Cities are growing, but desert areas are expanding at the same time. Habitable and usable land has been halved over the past 50 years. The environment can no longer keep pace. Acid rain is falling on one-third of the Chinese territory. Half of the water in our 7 largest rivers is completely useless, while one-fourth of our citizens does not have access to clean drinking water. One-third of the urban population is breathing polluted air, and less than 20% of the trash in cities is treated and processed in an environmentally sustainable manner. Finally, 5 of the 10 most polluted cities worldwide are in China. Because air and water are polluted, we are losing between 8% and 15% of our gross domestic product. And that doesn't include the costs for health. Then there's the human suffering. In Beijing alone, 70% to 80% of all deadly cancer cases are related to the environment. lung cancer has emerged as the number one cause of death. No, those are not problems any government could ignore, let alone the rest of us. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reports that on some days, almost 25% of the polluting matter in the air above Los Angeles originated in China. One of the most famous pictures to ever come out of China was Chairman Mao swimming in the Yangtze River. But as Andreas Lorenz observed in a Der Spiegel essay, November 28, 2005, on the toxic pollution that has now poisoned so many of China's rivers and lakes, nowadays, Chairman Mao Zedong's legendary swimming outing in the Yangtze River in 1966 would no longer be seen as evidence of his strength, but more as a suicide attempt. Beyond this general trend toward environmental degradation, China's leadership was clearly alarmed by a sudden surge in energy use in recent years. As the team of experts who follow China's environment at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory explained to me, between 1980 and 2000, China's GDP quadrupled, but its total energy usage only doubled, a sign of good energy and resource efficiency and tight government controls. Post-2001, however, the new government in Beijing loosened monetary policy, and China's entry into the World Trade Organization dramatically increased foreign investment in the country, particularly for manufacturing, and this turbocharged China's exports. In the process, China fell off the wagon in terms of energy efficiency, alarming the leadership. Between 2001 and 2005, growth in energy usage in China outpaced growth of its GDP. In 2005, it was 40% faster, as the Chinese at once embarked on a massive and energy-intensive buildup of its nationwide physical infrastructure, took on the dirty industries being shed by the West, and just began to live more comfortably in bigger apartments with air conditioning, TVs, and computers. Finally, China's leadership began to act because of climate change. In just the past 2 years, China's leaders, like many others around the world, have come to realize that climate change is not only real, but appears to be changing China's own climate in potentially disastrous ways much faster than anyone had anticipated. China's average temperature in 2007 was 10.3 degrees centigrade, 50.5 degrees Fahrenheit, which made 2007 the warmest year since the establishment of a national climate observation network in 1951. The Beijing Review reported January 4, 2008. This record-high temperature, which marked the 11th year in a row that the national average temperature has been higher than in a normal year, was remarkably higher than the second highest figure of 9.9 degrees centigrade, 50 degrees Fahrenheit, in 2006. In December 2006, China's government issued its first official report on climate change. It noted that glaciers in the nation's northwest had decreased by 21% since the 1950s, and that all of China's major rivers had shrunk over the past five decades. "Global climate change has an impact on the nation's ability to develop further," said the Ministry of Science and Technology, one of 12 government departments that prepared the report. Liu Zhudu, Deputy Director of the Global Environmental Affairs Office of the Ministry of Science and Technology, told China's Xinhua News Agency, October 4, 2007, that "climate change has begun to take its toll in China in recent years, and we shouldn't wait till it is too late to take action." In China's National Climate Change Program, June 4, 2007, the government pledged to restructure the economy, promote clean energy technologies, and improve energy efficiency. China is the world's biggest producer and consumer of coal, using coal-fired power to meet 80% of its vast energy needs. It adds roughly 1 gigawatt of coal-fired power every 2 weeks. Liu told Xinhua that if climate change remains unchecked, the yield of China's major crops, including wheat, rice, and corn, will drop by up to 37% in the second half of this century. Global warming will also reduce the river levels and lead to more droughts and floods. And water supply in western China will fall short of demand by up to 20 billion cubic meters from 2010 to 2030, he said. Climate change also presents a major threat to ecologically vulnerable areas such as the Qinghai Tibet Plateau, which is the water tower of China, the Xinhua report noted. Less water in the rivers is not only bad for farmers, but will also significantly decrease hydropower, which will make China even more dependent on coal than it is now. But recognizing the problem and its urgency is only half the battle for China's leadership. Getting the whole system to respond, from cities to provinces to the central government, and from the public sector to the private sector, is another matter. In September 2007, I visited Beijing in the middle of an Indian summer. Every time I went to interview a Chinese official in his office, I found myself loosening my tie and exclaiming, "Hey, is it a little warm in here, or is it just me?" No, I was told, it wasn't just me. In June 2007, China's State Council had ordered, in the way only China could, that all government agencies, associations, companies, and private owners in public buildings must set their air conditioning thermostats to no lower than 26 degrees Celsius or 79 degrees Fahrenheit. Air conditioning consumes one-third of the electricity demand in China in summer, and you could definitely feel the difference in public offices. A few days later, I was reading some reports from China's English language newspapers, and I came across an item from the Shanghai Daily. It said the municipality had sent out teams to see who was complying with the government's air conditioning edict, and they found that more than half of the city's public buildings have failed to obey power-saving rules setting air conditioning at 26 degrees Celsius, according to local energy authorities. That, in a nutshell, is the good news, the bad news, and the interesting news from China today. The good news is that the government has decided to step in and take over people's thermostats in public buildings. That is an indication of seriousness. The bad news is that in the provinces and cities outside Beijing, and even inside Beijing, local officials are not afraid to ignore the State Council's environmental edicts. As the old Chinese saying goes, the sky is high and the emperor is far away. But the interesting news is that someone ordered the Shanghai Daily, a state-run newspaper, to expose those city buildings and officials who were ignoring the air conditioning order, something I'm not sure would have happened 5 years ago. And the really, really interesting news is that maybe nobody ordered the Shanghai Daily to write this story. Instead, maybe entrepreneurial journalists, sensing a relevant space in which they could report like real journalists and effect social change and have political cover to boot, went out and did the reporting on their own. That's the new China. In many ways, it is these three trends that are fighting it out in China today. A leadership that understands the problem and is taking serious measures, a system that is so big and diffuse and has so much momentum for growth that slowing it down is extremely difficult, even for an authoritarian government, and the first tentative steps to enlist civil society and media in China on the side of environmentalism. It is not clear which trend is going to win. Certainly, China's initial effort to green its GDP from the top down has met with enormous resistance from the capitalist system unleashed in the early 1970s, as ad hoc coalitions of local government and business officials who benefited from cowboy capitalism eluded whatever edicts came down from Beijing, sometimes in cahoots with high officials there. China is a veritable unstoppable growth machine, wrote the China experts Elizabeth C. Economy and Kenneth Lieberthal in their Harvard Business Review essay, June 2007, on China's environmental problems. Scorched earth. Will environmental risks in China overwhelm the opportunities? The fact that the Communist Party's legitimacy depended on maintaining economic growth, they noted, meant that any environmental regulations that got in the way of growth tended to be ignored or watered down one way or the other. China's political system is built on five layers: national, provincial, municipal, county, and township, explained Economy and Lieberthal, with the Communist Party sitting atop all five. For officials who are trying to move up the system, success is rewarded in two ways, they noted. Formally, annual performance evaluations are pegged primarily to GDP growth in each jurisdiction. Informally, local officials personally benefit financially from that growth by investing in or holding positions in key firms, by assigning relatives to management positions, by engaging in plain vanilla corruption, and so on. This system has unleashed so many official entrepreneurs, said Economy and Lieberthal, that if the Chinese Communist Party were aptly named, it would really be called the China Bureaucratic Capitalist Party. Party leaders at all levels, they added, are entrepreneurial tigers hell-bent on using political power directly in league with local public and private enterprises to spur rapid GDP growth in their own bailiwicks. The whole system enabled local officials to protect their enterprises from meaningful implementation of environmental laws and regulations, added Economy and Lieberthal. Indeed, officials often require that enterprises in their jurisdictions ignore such laws and regulations in their quest for ongoing GDP growth. Then, in an effort to offset any fines the companies may have to pay for environmental transgressions, officials cover up the resulting problems in their reports to higher levels, interfere in the local courts to prevent adverse rulings, and bestow tax breaks, bank loans, and other financial support on affected enterprises. It was for all these reasons that Beijing's Green GDP Initiative in 2005 and 2006, which promised to judge Chinese officials on how well they protected their environment and deduct points for environmental degradation from their GDP growth numbers, never had any impact. It was difficult to calculate and measure uniformly, and local officials resisted implementing such a green yardstick. So the initiative died an early death. So too did some early goals. China's 10th five-year plan, which began in 2001, called for a 10% reduction in sulfur dioxide in China's air. And when that plan concluded in 2005, sulfur dioxide pollution in China had increased by 27%. What China's leaders apparently realized from that 10th five-year plan, their first serious foray into green policy, was that taking China from communism to capitalism was actually easier than trying to take it from dirty capitalism to clean capitalism. Because going from communism to state-directed capitalism, while by no means easy, involved taking the lid off of people who were yearning to be entrepreneurial, wildcatting capitalists. It involved unleashing something long suppressed in the Chinese culture, and the results of all that unleashed energy are apparent everywhere. But going from dirty GDPism to green GDPism is about restraining and redirecting all that natural energy. And to do that effectively requires a system with some judicial independence so that courts can discipline government-owned factories and power plants. It requires a freer press that can report on polluters without restraint, even if they are government-owned businesses. it requires more transparent laws and regulations so citizen activists know their rights and can feel free to confront polluters, no matter how powerful. And most of all, it requires growth based on sustainable energy productivity, not growth based on dirty energy productivity. Although China's leadership underestimated how hard it would be to change the engine on their bus from a dirty combustion engine going at full throttle to a hybrid, here's what's interesting. They have not backed off. There were more than a few signs in 2007 and 2008 that they've actually decided to double their green bets, and that is going to make the early 21st century politically very interesting in China. It is almost as if a light went on in the Chinese Politburo. The leadership realized that if it did not tackle this environment, energy, climate problem, dirty air, as much as slower growth, would undermine the stability and legitimacy of the Communist Party. Therefore, finding a way to grow green was becoming an imperative, not an option. It was a survival strategy. In that sense, China's leadership is becoming like those of many other governments around the world in the energy climate era, shifting the basis of its legitimacy from the ability to defend China's borders, which is now taken as a given, to the ability to deliver a higher living standard and to protect the nation from environmental degradation and energy and climate disruptions. So what we've started seeing with the 11th five-year plan, 2006 to 2010, is Beijing pushing with one hand even more extensive green laws from the top and, with the other hand, opening things up a little to enable more change from the bottom, fitfully giving more power to its citizens and newspapers to expose environmental crimes and to bring pressure to bear on those local officials and factories that want to continue exploiting the old, cheap coal-based system. And, with a third hand, the Chinese leadership is pushing the bureaucracy and the private sector to pursue the enormous economic opportunities inherent in clean power and energy efficiency, telling them, in effect, to get green is glorious. China's 11th five-year plan includes a goal of reducing energy intensity, energy consumption per unit of GDP, by 20% below 2005 levels across the whole economy by 2010. It's estimated that this would result in about 1.5 billion tons of avoided CO2 emissions. That target is five times as ambitious as the commitment announced by the European nations under the Kyoto Protocol. China's National Development and Reform Commission, which oversees all these energy programs, has spread out the target reductions among provinces and industrial sectors. And this time, the leadership expressly made meeting these goals part of every government official's personnel assessment. This gives it teeth. Individuals are now accountable for meeting key energy efficiency and environment goals. In 2006 and 2007, however, China fell short of the annual 4% goal in energy efficiency that it needs to reach the 20% improvement by 2010. Until I see a major governor or industry manager sacked for realizing his or her GDP goals but failing to meet their green targets, I will remain skeptical. But it is, at least on paper, a much more serious approach than any China has ever had. Unfortunately, the challenge China's leaders face today is much more serious as well. The sheer scale and scope of urbanization is staggering. By 2020, the urban population is expected to increase from 42 to 60%, equivalent to tens of millions of new urban residents and hundreds of new satellite cities, notes Jiang Lin, senior vice president of the China Sustainable Energy Program, in his May 2008 report. Accompanying urban population growth has been skyrocketing demand for the energy-intensive materials of which new buildings, roads, power plants, and factories are built. This is, he added, the largest migration in human history. To give the government more muscle, in March 2008, China's Politburo also elevated the status of the State Environmental Protection Agency, a famously toothless watchdog agency, into a full-fledged cabinet ministry, with more staff and a bigger budget. China has adopted several world-class policies in just the past 2 years, and they are working on more. In a couple of areas, they are now actually leading the United States, notes David Moskovitz, director and co-founder of the Regulatory Assistance Project, a U.S. nonprofit research group that works on conservation issues in many countries, including China. On January 1, 2006, China instituted a national renewable energy mandate, of the sort the U.S. Congress rejected in 2007, that requires China's provincial governments to develop and adopt renewable energy for their localities. China's target is to increase renewable energy, particularly wind, hydro, and biomass, to 16% of its total energy production by 2020. Today, it is 7%. China also adopted world-class mileage standards for its cars. In October 2007, Moskovitz pointed out, China also imposed a new rule on power plants, which said that instead of burning the cheapest fuel first, such as coal, they had to use the cleanest fuel first, natural gas, solar, or wind, if it is available. It drives demand for cleaner fuels and, on a day-to-day basis, has had an immediate effect on emissions, said Moskovitz. If we adopted it in America, it would make a huge difference. In an effort to weed out polluting and energy-intensive industries, China has also instituted a differential pricing system, whereby state power companies now charge higher electricity prices to the least efficient industrial concerns and lower prices to the more efficient ones, in an effort to reward the most efficient producers and force the least efficient to either change or shut down. So the most efficient steel mill wins in two ways, by having lower energy use and lower energy prices, and the least efficient loses in two ways, having higher energy use and prices, and therefore higher production costs, said Moskovitz. We can't get our power companies to even think about doing that. China is now in the midst of a program of shutting down its most inefficient small power plants, totaling around 50 gigawatts, or 8% of China's total generating capacity, by 2010. Most important, while every American energy bill is just the sum of all lobbies, with very little long-term strategic thinking, in 2006, China began drafting a comprehensive national energy law that will provide a long-term strategy for the whole country, and the leadership has been circulating it to experts for comments to get it right, rather than just promulgating it from on high. The proof will be in the breathing. China still has a long, long way to go to even get close to America's environmental profile, considering that its energy consumption is growing at about 15% a year, while in America, consumption is growing at 1 or 2%. They are not efficient, said Moskovitz, but they are becoming more efficient quickly, because with their growth, they are bringing in a lot of new plants, so their average efficiency level is improving. The more China's leadership pushes to make green growth real, the more it is staking its credibility on this goal. Therefore, one has to wonder whether the leadership can afford not to empower China's civil society and unleash it as a green watchdog that can buttress these new regulations being passed from the top so they actually get implemented this time. China's citizens are the leadership's only ally against the bureaucratic and private sector dirty GDPists. This is the dynamic I am tracking most closely. Green movements historically have started as grassroots movements.